Good afternoon, everyone. First meeting for the second session of the 27th Legislature. So we call the House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. First thing is housekeeping. We have a cell phone in the on position. If you do, we ask that you make sure it's not going to ring during the meeting. 1 p.m. Wednesday, January 25th. We have present Representative Lynn, Representative Keller. We will not have Representative Pruitt. We do have Representative Gruenberg, Representative Holmes, Vice Chair Representative Thompson, myself, Chair Gatto. Today's agenda includes an overview of six court decisions. I always thought a court decision was the end of the line, but we'll go back and visit them, which can be found in the Legislative Legal Services Report, dated December 2011, otherwise known as the Yellow Book. First one is Williams versus Barbie, then two is Christofferson versus State, three is State versus Alyeska, four is Calvert versus State, five is Manzula versus Voorhees, and six is Marathon Oil versus State. Let's take these one at a time.
Mr. Chair.
Just a second. I'm going to try to devote about 15 minutes to each case. If we can't complete in the allotted time, I guess we'll have to come back later and deal with it again. We have legal services attorneys here, Jean Michelle, Dennis Bailey, Don Bullock, and Representative Gruenberg, you had a comment?
Yeah, we also have Jerry Luck up back there.
Well, look at that. It's a great day already.
there was something else I would like to discuss if it's agreeable with you a little bit, and that is on here, I think it was page one, they had recommended that they put here laws that are going to sunset, and I had talked to staff about also looking at some of these potentially, and I'm falling down on the job. I haven't looked at the statutes myself, but at some point we should take a look and see if we need, like there's a handgun bill and stuff that are going to sunset unless we do something with them.
I'm just reading the statute as we speak.
Oh, okay.
that'll be the subject of a different meeting.
Okay.
Because I don't think we're going to have time left at the end of this meeting.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a quick question?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I was just wondering, I was looking through, flipping through the book, and it talks about different court cases, and for some, our attorneys have recommended no action at all because it looks like it's, and others they say you should take a look. And we're looking at a good subset of those today, and a couple of them I think we looked at over the interim. I'm just curious, are we going to look at all the ones that recommend, because there are some that it...
We can.
I'm just curious what the selection process was.
The number that we could deal with today.
Okay.
That we put in a priority because some of them said no legislative action required.
Yeah.
But you know, if anybody on the committee wants to specifically hear one, that's what our job is. We'll hear it.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just was wanted to.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, the one that we looked at previously is on page 8. It's the Bridge case, and that was introduced today, and is referred to this committee in finance, so we now will have a bill in front of us on that.
Okay. So number one is Williams versus Barbie.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jean Michelle with the Legislative Council Legal Services.
Just let me interrupt 1 second. Mm-hmm. Susan is going to recording, and whenever she knows you, but when if anybody else comes up whose name is easy to misspell, please spell it for us, but I think we're probably going to be okay here today. So, sorry, proceed.
No problem. Welcome back.
We're so pleased to be back.
I'm happy. We're
happy brought our
here.
Snow shovel and our boots. Oh, I'm sorry. Melanie Lesh is here, too, our Gustavus representative, who is my... Legislative Committee aide for Judiciary. Anybody left? I think we got it. Okay. Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. I just want to back up a bit and explain the purpose of the oversight report. I know that you all have gone through these thoroughly in the past, but each year we publish these reports for any legislator to look at and perhaps propose legislation on the basis of any concerns they might have from the court cases summarized here. We, as your staff, do review every published opinion federal, state, and attorney general opinions before summarizing the cases that we think are relevant to your duties as legislators. And we have some guidance in AS 2420065A that tells us what we should be reporting on. And so we look at these opinions and make a judgment call about whether or not the courts are properly implementing legislative purposes, whether a court or agency expresses a concern or some dissatisfaction with the statute or common law in the state, whether the opinion or decision indicates clear or ambiguous statutes, unclear or ambiguous statutes, and whether the courts have modified common law that you, as lawmakers, might want to codify in statute and perhaps amend.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we pass legislation, but it comes through legal, and we vote on it, and then the reviser of statute says, "Ooh, we're referring to an organization that doesn't exist," and they fix it. And still, we don't hit the mark exactly yet. So then it goes to a judge who says, it's not clear, or I'm not sure what your intent is, or the language doesn't tell me what your intent is. Is that the procedure that this goes through? And then we wind up here with you.
More or less. Yeah, that's a very shortened version. The ambiguity sometimes is known ahead of time, and sometimes there is this very specific set of facts that the legislators, the committee members, and your legislative council had not anticipated in drafting a bill. And so courts are faced with very specific circumstances in interpreting the law that you don't always have the availability to do. And judges are especially equipped to look for problems and for violations of constitutional rights or other issues. We, of course, try to advise you about that before you pass a bill, but we're not always right, and sometimes your constituents really want something to happen, and so it ends up in court. So we look at the judicial opinions as they interpret the laws that the legislature passes.
And so here we hear it today. And
right.
Where does it go once it leaves here then?
Well,
is there an opinion that goes back to a judge or?
No, your authority as legislators is to introduce a bill and or a resolution. Resolution is a little questionable when you're telling a judge you think they were wrong, but essentially your duty here as a committee member is either to individually or as a committee to propose legislation based on your determination about whether or not the court was correct in interpreting the law, either common law or statute. And if they are, you can leave the opinion as is. It's a published opinion. It's enforceable just as your statutory laws are. But if you'd like to modify the decision of the court in any way, then your authority is to introduce legislation to change that.
So we're at the top of the food chain.
In a manner, I mean, it's three branches of government. At this point, you are. Right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the first case really has already been resolved, and this is a good example of what the legislative body can do to either accept or reject or modify a court opinion. And in Williams versus Barbie, there was a question raised about whether the statutory presumption against awarding custody to a person who had a history of perpetrating domestic violence, whether that presumption against that award applied when child custody order was being modified by a court, because we had two separate statutes. One statute talked about the best interests of the child when they were modifying a child custody order, and the other statute described the best interests of the child for purposes of the original order, and those two statutes weren't necessarily cross-referencing each other. And the court said that we had, they had a duty, the purpose of both the initial custody order statute and the modification statutes were the same, and that was protection of children and to serve their best interests. And so they applied the presumption against awarding child custody to a perpetrator of domestic violence in a modification. It was kind of an interesting factual scenario because the domestic violence information was known to both parents when they entered into the original custody agreement, but the modification was made partly on the basis of a criminal conviction for one of those instances of domestic violence. And the time frame was very short. It was a couple of weeks after the original custody order was accepted by the court. There was another reason for modifying the custody order, but in 2010, in the 26th legislative session, you passed a bill that added the presumption against the award into the modification statute. So there's nothing further that really needed to be, in my opinion, it needs to be done with this case.
When you have a custody case, how old is a child, can a child be, before it's considered something else?
18.
Mm-hmm.
After age 14, the child gets a say in where the custody order, or who gets primary custody. Well, maybe it's not strictly 14.
No, it's not a specific age. It says if the child's of suitable age and discretion, the court may consider the child's wishes. And it not only depends upon the age of the child, it depends upon the facts of the case. I have had a case where the court considered a child as young as 5, and another case where the child was a teenager but wanted to live with the parent that promised her a horse, and they didn't consider that. The whole horse, not just one end.
Bribery.
In this case, I looked at it also, and what they did was they said the court should have considered additional evidence at the lower level and remanded it so that the evidence could be presented. And I agree with Ms. Michelle that I don't think any legislative action is warranted. I'm glad we're discussing it, but it seemed like a well-reasoned case to me.
It's on the record, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next case is Christofferson versus the State of Alaska Child Custody Investigator's Office. And this case presented the question of whether a state can be held vicariously liable for actions of a child custody investigator appointed by the court. And your summary on your agenda is true, except the court went a little bit further, and the court acknowledged in an earlier case that child custody investigators appointed by the court and experts appointed by courts enjoyed quasi-judicial immunity as long as they're performing duties that are consistent with their court appointment. And so this child custody investigator was found to have absolute quasi-judicial immunity for her actions. I don't know how much you want to get into the facts of the case, but basically she had somewhat delayed reporting of a sexual misconduct charge involving a child who was being placed in the home of the father and two half-siblings. And before the custody investigator reported that she discovered that in court records, there was a 4-month time lag, and during that 4-month time lag, the child had been temporarily placed with the father and the two half-siblings and had assaulted one of them. And so the parents had assaulted one of the daughters, the half-siblings. So the parents, the father of the teenage boy and the two young girls and the stepmother sued the state for $10 million for the assault.
Was the assault just a physical beating, or was there any sex involved?
You know, they just referred to it as sexual misconduct. This wasn't the criminal trial. In fact, the case was dismissed because the mother of the child who was originally... Oh, I'm not sure about the half-sibling. The original case in which the kid was investigated for sexual misconduct was dismissed. But it was reported by the child investigator. It just came out in her report to the court 4 months after she discovered it. The parents didn't sue the child custody investigator directly. They sued the state. The state was clearly immune under our statutes. And so the question at the Supreme Court level on appeal was whether or not the state could be held vicariously liable for non-immune conduct of the child custody investigator. But first the court said, we find the child custody investigator to be immune as well, to enjoy the same level of immunity, absolute quasi-judicial immunity, as the state does. And that wasn't a new finding. But finally, the court said that the state could not be held vicariously liable even if there were no immunity under the quasi-judicial immunity principles, because in the court's opinion, the same rationale for enjoying quasi-judicial immunity for a custody investigator or any court appointee applies to the state who is employing or contracting for those services, and that is to protect the children and to allow the appointee, in this case the child custody investigator, to perform his or her duties in a way that the person felt was necessary.
Doesn't the state have immunity, and they can only allow you to sue them with permission?
Yes, that's true, and we do have many statutes that provide for limited liability. But in this case, there was no liability of the state, as it was sued directly, and parents' attorney got creative and suggested that the vicarious liability might get them to pierce the immunity, and the court found that the vicarious liability or the quasi-judicial immunity applied vicariously to the state as well. And I don't know what I recommended initially. I just thought you might question that, whether states should or should not be vicariously liable for a court appointee. The court didn't look at separate tort liability. They stopped at the question of whether or not the custody investigator was performing within the scope of her appointment and found that they were. So I don't know what would happen if it were a straight personal injury case in which a court appointee was found to be acting outside the appointment. But I'm guessing that the vicarious liability might become an issue again.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I owe you and the staff an apology. I have looked at these, and I had a note to read this thing, this one case, and I forgot to, so I'm just looking at it now. Looking at it at first blush, it seems, and I would agree with Ms. Michelle, it looks like the court is following well-established legal principles in affirming the dismissal of the case. That's been the law of this state for about 17 years, and it's the law in almost all other jurisdictions. Judicial immunity is absolute immunity. You can't sue a judge for their decision. And lawyers generally in court enjoy the same immunity, unless it's malicious or something like that. And a court custody investigation is an arm of the court, so it logically follows they should have the same immunity. And that's the law in almost all the other states. If what I think Ms. Michelle is saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if somebody acts outside the scope of their authority, like they're malicious, and they deliberately put a child into an endangering situation because they don't like the kid or something like that, then that would be what's called ultra vires, and they're no longer outside the scope of their authority, and they're no longer protected by that. The reason I was going to think about this case is because there's a case in California, it's called Tarasoff, where a person was institutionalized and allegedly the people let the person out too soon and they murdered somebody or did something like that. And the court held that in certain circumstances there is no immunity for something like that. But I think that's a far cry from what we're talking about here, and I would just, with the permission of the chair, say I assume that this would not undercut a Tarasoff type of a situation. This is quite different, is it not, through the chair, Ms. Michelle?
Through the chair, I agree with that. The court actually in this, and Christofferson, compared this to another case in which the court appointee was acting within the scope of their...
The Janet Gwynn case.
Right.
Yeah. So in that, I would recommend we just take no action in this case.
Okay. Thank you. And with me are Dennis Bailey and Don Bullock. Dennis will cover the workers' comp and unemployment compensation cases. And Don is our oil and gas expert, as you all know.
This next one is insurance, isn't it?
It is.
Workers' comp.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dennis Bailey with Legislative Legal Services, and I'm here to summarize a couple of the cases that we have in our book for review by the legislature. The first case is the Division of Insurance versus Alaska Pipeline Service Company. The case involves an insurance program that was authorized by statute that allows a project owner of a construction project to essentially combine the insurance on the project into one package. And in this case, Alaska Pipeline entered into an insurance program for general liability and workers' compensation that provided insurance for themselves and several of their subcontractors or other participants in the program. It wasn't actually a subcontractor. The organization that became an issue in the case was Alyeska Pipeline's maintenance and service provider, and they were covered under the insurance program. The Division of Insurance concluded that the maintenance and service provider didn't fall within the provisions of the broad insurance program because it wasn't involved in an insurance, in a construction project. So they issued a cease and desist order that says that, that Alyeska had to stop participation by the people who were doing maintenance and service duties. The history of the case is a little bit complex to sort out when you read the case, but eventually, after the cease and desist order was issued, an administrative law judge considered the case and said, we agree with the, or I agree with the decision of the division, and that this is not included, this is not a program that, or a service that should be included in the broad insurance plan. The deputy director of the reversed the administrative law judge and said, oh, yes, it is. And the Superior Court reviewed the decision of the deputy director and said, oh, no, it isn't. So the Supreme Court basically agreed with the Supreme Court and said that the language of the statute was clear enough. It applied to construction projects, and the service and maintenance wasn't a construction project, and that the service and maintenance project didn't fall within the statute, and they weren't going to, as they said, invade the province of the legislature by extending the plain language to mean something else. And basically they said that well, the conclusion was that service and maintenance contracts were not construction projects, and they didn't fall within the meaning of the statute that allows these programs for the to be consolidated for construction projects. They reviewed the legislative intent or the legislative testimony, and that supported their decision. Now, the reason this was included in the review of decisions because the legislature can decide whether they want to include service contracts or service and maintenance contracts within the construction project owner's insurance plan or not. And there's a discussion of the rationale that supported the decision that, and the legislative testimony when the bill was passed, really that indicated that it wasn't desirable to have this be a broad program that applied outside of the construction context. So that's the first case.
But this had to do with a woman who quit?
No, that's not this case. This is an insurance case with Alyeska Pipeline. The one you're thinking of is the next one.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
When I looked at this, I was not particularly knowledgeable about this area. And what this committee has done in the past is when we've gotten a case that may or may not warrant review but is within the purview of another committee, mm-hmm. we have sent a letter to the committee with the case and the relevant pages referring that to the committee for further action. And that would be my recommendation here. I note Lindsay, Representative Holmes, is on that committee. I don't know if anybody else, Representative Thompson.
Labor and Commerce?
Yeah. So that I would think that if they would agree that we should.
Well, that was.
Chairman, I have LNC issue written in the margin of my.
That was part of the plan. I don't see any objection to forwarding it to the committee. The committee would want it, and we shouldn't hold back from it. So. LNC, you're sure? Not commerce, community, not resources, not.
Not fisheries.
Not fisheries.
All right, so put that one to bed and go on to the next one.
The next case is also a Supreme Court case. All of these cases came out last year, so that's the 2011 case. This one involves an application of the unemployment insurance benefits statute. And The case is quite factually oriented. There's a number of facts that went into the equation that affected the court's decision. But essentially, the Supreme Court and the lower courts as well, but the Supreme Court in confirming the lower courts, relied heavily on the Department of Labor's and Workforce Development's benefit policy manual for interpretation of how the unemployment benefits law would be applied. And in this case, the employer quit her job voluntarily and applied for unemployment benefits for a number of reasons, which I'll go into in a minute. Basically, the unemployment benefit statute says that if you quit a suitable job without good cause, your benefits are reduced. And they're reduced by extending the waiting period before you get before you receive unemployment benefits. So that if you quit without good cause, you have to wait 6 weeks instead of 1 week. And the full extent of your benefits are also reduced by three times your weekly, I want to say weekly benefit, but it's not the precise language. Anyway, the benefits are reduced. So she went to battle with the unemployment insurance people and lost. The basis of her argument was that she had transportation difficulties. She couldn't get to work because her bike broke down.
Where did this take place?
Cannery worked in Soldotna, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, it wasn't out on the chain or anything like that?
I think if memory serves correctly, that's where it was.
Right.
Transportation issues can be a good cause for leaving your position voluntarily. Her transportation difficulties involved a broken bike. It involved her shift times. Her shift times were irregular, so that it was difficult for her to take public transportation or to take her bike. She had to bike 10 miles. The employer previously had a 3-hour lead time for informing the employees of a shift where they needed to work, but changed it to a shorter period. She had relied on her bicycle for the previous season to get to work from apparently the same location where she was living.
You said that was 10 miles?
That's what the case said. She rode 10 miles. And there was apparently a public transportation system, but it was difficult for her to use the public transportation system because her schedule was variable and the lead time for getting the information that she needed to work was irregular. There were a few other reasons that she felt that her leaving employment was for good cause. It involved personality conflicts with her employers, a change in the plant manager, and she didn't like the new manager, but they really weren't primary in the decision of the case. Probably most important, or at least one of the important factors in the decision, was that the employee acknowledged that she had not discussed the issues with the personality disagreements or transportation issues with her supervisor before she left work. That's one of the elements that's included in the benefit policy manual for the hearing officer to determine whether a person's entitled to unemployment benefits. Essentially, the Supreme Court based their decision on that factor, that the employee hadn't raised the issues to their employer and tried to resolve them before she quit.
If she had, and the employer has no options, so your bike is broken, so you have irregular shift hours, which is part of everybody's plan, they're still required to make some adjustments for an employee?
Well, I think that that presents an interesting question, although it wasn't exactly the question in the case. The case considered two aspects of the person leaving employment voluntarily with or without good cause. There are two factors that the court considers. One is the suitability of the job for the employer or for the employee, and the the suitability of the job is one issue, and the good cause for leaving is the second issue. So the suitability of the job in this case wasn't really contested, but the good cause issue was. I lost my train of thought for a second there, but. So the Supreme Court basically said that the suitability of the job and the good cause issues related to transportation existed, that if she had presented those issues to her employer, she may have had a case that said that her leaving the employment was for good cause. Basically, the Supreme Court concluded that the claimant had failed to show good cause, and she had to wait her additional period and have her benefits reduced. Now, this case was in your booklet for review for the purpose of considering how the division, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development's benefit policy manual applies to a particular circumstance. And the one might conclude that it was either fair or unfair in this particular set of facts, that a number, and actually I counted them, I think there were 20 different sections of this policy manual that were considered in this case, and to review whether the legislature feels that those are appropriate and whether they whether the policy manual, which implements the statute, is following the gist of the statute. So that would be the reason for including this case in your pamphlet.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, once again, this seems to me something that's more labor and commerce than this committee, and I would respectfully move that we refer it to that committee.
Any objections? None? Good idea.
The third case that I'm presenting to you today is called Monzuna versus Voorhees. This is a Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission case. The case is not particularly complex. Although there were a few questions about the procedures that were not particularly clear in the case. The Workers' Compensation Appeal Commission reviews decisions of the Workers' Compensation Board, and the claimant asked the Workers' Compensation Board to change the venue in the case. The venue is the location where the case is heard. It started off in Fairbanks. That was the initial location of venue.
Is the venue always the location where the incident happened as the first venue?
The initial presumption for venue is the case where is usually the case, sorry, the place where the accident happened or the event occurred. But it can be moved for the convenience of the litigants and the witnesses. And there were, as it turned out in this case, good reasons for moving the case to Anchorage. The claimant had moved to the Kenai Peninsula. The witnesses were no longer located in Fairbanks. And anyhow, the substantive decision isn't really the part of the case that's a subject of review by the legislature. The claimant had asked the board, I think it added up to four times, to move venue. The case was a dispute over the future medical payments. The main case had been settled, but they had reserved future medical payments, and they got into a dispute about that. So the board essentially said, we're not going to move venue to Anchorage. We don't want to, partly for our own benefit, the board's own benefit. The Supreme Court finally decided that, or the commission eventually granted the motion to change venue. And they said that, number one, you considered your own purposes as a board in the decision whether to move the venue or not, which was an inappropriate standard. You need to consider the interests of the witnesses and the parties, not the interest of the board. So it also concluded that there was insufficient evidence to find that Fairbanks continued to be the more convenient forum than Anchorage for the parties and the witnesses.
Is it an option? I mean, what would happen if it occurred in Fairbanks? I live in Palmer, but I wanted to have the case heard in Juneau. Is that over the edge, or?
Well, the decision maker, and in this case, it would have been the workers' comp appeals commission, would consider the factors of the convenience of the party, the location of the witnesses, whether all the witnesses were in Juneau in your case, whether the parties lived in Juneau, whether the accident or incident had occurred in Juneau. I mean, there's a number of factors that they might decide is where the best location is. So the decision to move the venue ended up before the Supreme Court, and the issue that arose was that the party that was challenging it, and actually it turned out to be the claimant that ended up challenging the fact that the commission had decided to move venue. Anyhow, it ended up before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, the issue was, does the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission have the authority to consider what's called an interlocutory appeal, an appeal before the final decision in the case, which is the norm? Does the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission have the authority to consider those interlocutory appeals? They are not specific or explicitly set out in the statute that they have that authority, although the statute, as was argued in the case, said that there were suggestions that may have been the intent of the legislature to authorize interlocutory appeal. The Supreme Court said that the appeal commission was acting in the same role as an appeal court because they're reviewing the decisions of the board, and they should have the same type of authority that an appeals court would have, and an appeals court has the authority to issue interlocutory decisions under the right circumstances. Venue is one of those circumstances. If it was really unfair to have the venue, in this case, stay in Fairbanks rather than Juneau, it would be unfair to require that the case go all the way through to completion before the commission could even decide the issue of whether the venue was proper. Now, there's an issue that's the reason that this case is before you. The question of whether the appeals commission has the authority to make interlocutory decisions before the final decision in the case. Now, if the legislature decides to deny interlocutory appeal, I think that there's a possibility that there would be constitutional issues about having a fair forum to hear your case. Now, I don't know that that would be the case, but I think it's an issue that at least piqued your curiosity as far as how it would turn out if the legislature decided that they wanted to explicitly exclude interlocutory appeals from the Workers' Comp Commission. But that's the case. That's the case that's before you for consideration. What you decide to do is up to you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
I thought this was an interesting case because it seems very clear to me that the commission should have the authority to take an interlocutory petition for review or something on a discretionary basis. And frankly, I don't know if other commissions and I don't know if there's anything else in state law that's quite like workers' comp where they have these various layers. I'm not even going to go there. But so the question is, really, in my mind, once again, I think this is within the primary jurisdiction of the Labor and Commerce Committee because they deal with workers' comp on an ongoing basis, and I would respectfully move we refer to that committee.
But this is about a venue location, not about the facts of the work comp, is it?
No. No, it's a question of whether the commission had the authority to take the case before a final decision of the board. It's a question of procedure, not venue. Venue just happened to be the issue. The question was whether they had jurisdiction at all.
And you feel that goes to LNC?
Yeah, because there's a specific administrative appeal procedure in the workers' comp area. And I have my own view, but I think that the committee that deals with workers' comp should be the one on a legislative, you know, we're talking about jurisdiction of committees here. Yeah. And I think that they should be the primary committee to deal with workers' comp, and I don't think we should make an exception in this case.
I'll agree with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Simple okay. We'll do it.
We can send them an omnibus letter.
You're going to say, don't you do your job every time you have three cases and they're coming over to us?
This is a simple year, you know, because, sometimes years we have a lot and this year we have one more case, I guess.
Right.
But ultimately, some of those sunset things, I think, I hope we take
them. Okay. So... This one going to go to resources when we're done?
Yeah, that was going to be my recommendation.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, you're getting off easy today.
But last time we had two cases we dealt with, putting them on a bill.
Well, this one might be ripe for resources and finance if you need to shut it off.
But at least I think we should hear so they can make a decision.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Bullock. I'm one of the attorneys in Legislative Legal Services, and I'm here to talk about the case of Marathon Oil Company against the State of Alaska Department of Natural Resources. This case has to do with the valuation of the state's royalty gas that the producers are required to pay to the state. Under the contract, the lease agreement, the value is determined using what they referred to as the four highest. They look for the highest price, which might be the field price received by the lessee, the volume weighted average of the three highest field or area prices, the lessee's posted price for the gas, or the volume weighted average of the three highest posted prices in the field area for similar gas. Now that scheme of determining the highest value often takes a number of years to be audited and to actually go verify the values. In the meantime, the producers pay royalty on a monthly basis, so at some point there's an adjustment. And under utility contracts, where gas was provided primarily for consumers or for the generation of electricity, the utilities bore the brunt of any increase in the royalty, and that was passed forward. So in 1986, the legislature enacted AS 380580, AA and BB. And this allowed a producer to present a request to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to use the contract price as the valuation of the gas. In other words, what they had agreed to sell the gas to the utility. So if that was settled, then there wasn't the pass-forward burden on the consumers. The issue in the case came up because Marathon began producing in the area around Inelchik in 2003. In 2008, they submitted a request to the commissioner to use the contract price. And the commissioner granted it because the statutory is mandatory, and it says that you shall use the contract price except unless there are certain conditions present. The commissioner granted the use of the contract price. Marathon said, we'd really like to go back to 2003 when we started producing. Could we use the contract price all the way back? And the commissioner said no. And then the longstanding position of the Department of Natural Resources was that it was prospective only. And the words of the statute that the commissioner relied on were the language that the court found was ambiguous, and it says prospective reduction in royalty receipts. So under the statute, the commissioner shall allow the contract price unless the commissioner makes a written finding based on clear and convincing evidence that the prospective reduction in royalty receipts would not be balanced by increased benefits to in-state gas and electric consumers. So based on that language, the Department of Natural Resources said that this is a prospective only. And the court deferred to the Department of Natural Resources because they're the ones that manage the royalty. And this was the result of a long-standing interpretation that was the result of adjudication by the Department of Natural Resources. And therefore, they said that, first of all, they agreed that it was ambiguous, as the Superior Court had said. And they deferred to the department so that the use of the contract price went only forward from the date that the contract price option was accepted by the commissioner.
Let me ask you a question. If you're a company and you are either delivering gas to a utility in Anchorage for a contract price, or you're exporting it to Japan for a contract price, and the prices differ, which one becomes the contract price, or is each one handled as separate contract price?
Well, the lease provisions apply except for the exceptions. So in the case of Japan, which isn't addressed specifically in the statute, they'd look at those other prices for similar gas from the same area as value. But the statute specifically addresses the situation where the gas is being sold for the generation of electricity or for use by consumers. So it was a specific exception. And the court addressed the policy behind that, and one of the reasons they took, which was a conservative approach, in that the application of the contract price would go forward only and not backwards, was because of the general policy for the use of natural resources in the state, which is to maximize revenue to the state. And it weighed the interests of the people in the rest of the state that would get something that goes into the general fund where the royalties go, as well as the permanent fund, versus the benefit of capping the royalties at the contract price for a particular area of the state. So it was, as a matter of policy, in addition to the longstanding determination by DNR, that they said that they would not apply the contract price retroactively.
Representative Grunberg?
Once again, I think this is something that's within the Resources Committee's jurisdiction. We're getting into retroactivity and stuff like that, so I'd respectfully move we refer to that committee.
Agree. Mm-hmm. Okay. A wave of the hand on its way to Resources.
I think this is a helpful exercise to go.
And that is the final one that we have programmed, and we're only halfway into our allotted time.
Mr. Chair, I will, if it's agreeable, look at the repealer stuff, and then maybe Representative Keller can look at the handgun thing, and I'll look at the rest and talk to staff and see if we want to either refer some of them out or take up some of them ourselves. That's on pages 1 and 2 of it.
Yeah.
Is that okay with you, Wes?
Yeah, right. I would also like to look into the
education.
Right, good.
The one on health care insurance.
We can talk, and I'll take the ones that you
want. Mr. Chairman, what page is that one on?
Say again?
I was wondering what page that was, the health care appeal.
It's on the second page, bottom one. The law is enacted in 2011.
Health care insurance and related matters. Okay, thank you.
So we've cleared the books of ambiguity.
Let me ask, since we're dividing this stuff up, you're looking at the health care insurance one, right? And then how about school construction and maintenance? Are you on the education committee?
No.
Yes. Health and social services.
Okay, health, okay. And I'll look, and you're going to do the handgun, and I'll look at the other ones.
And Attorney Holmes, how about you? You going to be looking at anything or all of them?
Chairman, I'm keeping my head down on this one.
The one that caught my eye was the electronic monitoring.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, the one on education committee, we'll ultimately have to refer that to the education committee.
Electronic monitoring was putting a GPS on somebody's car?
No, that was a Supreme Court case. The ankle bracelet, it was Bob Book's bill, remember, and I think we just did it for 2 years, and the question is whether to keep it permanently, which we'll probably want to do, I assume.
I will put the education ones, also the one on the recruitment and retention report on the teachers. Anyway, I recommend that Lance at least be given the opportunity, as he's on the education committee, to focus on those a bit. And I will be happy to remind him that they're there.
So you and Lance will do that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, unless you notify otherwise.
And then how about the continuation of the education committee?
Yeah.
You too, go ahead. Now, sports fishing, do you want to do that? Because you were chair of the resources.
Yeah, but that would probably be fisheries first and then resources.
Steve?
You bet.
Yeah, he'll do that one.
Fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. I'll do the municipal property tax exemptions. Oh, you want me to look at that? I'll look at that.
That sounds like us, yeah.
I don't know. No, or CNRA.
Is that right?
Well, probably. I'll take a look at it. And then school construction. We've looked at that before. I'll look at that, too. Okay. Done.
Done?
And I'll get a report from you.
Any reason why we shouldn't adjourn? Anyone? Well, that's easy. We are adjourned.